New Testament Use of the Old Testament. The fourth talk in a series on issues in biblical interpretation was presented by Ron Julian on November 27, 1990, at McKinsey Study Center, an institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2013. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
What we're going to do tonight is talk about an area. It may seem a little bit abstract. It's not something that we run into every time we open the Bible and try to understand what's happening there, but it's very much related to some of the questions that we've been talking about the last 3 weeks, because this area calls into question a lot of the things that I have been saying about how we ought to approach the Bible. And that area is the way the New Testament uses the Old Testament. I've been arguing for things like authorial intent, you know, and trying to find out what the author meant and what it meant in that context and how the language would have been understood by the people of the time and taking the genre into account and all of those things that we've been saying. And I think it's fair to say that if we could demonstrate that the New Testament authors, in fact, had no such concern, and that when they interpreted the Old Testament, which is part of our Bible, that that's not the way they did it, then I would have some explaining to do as to why I would suggest that that's the way we ought to approach the Bible. And I'm sure you're familiar with the kind of problem that we can run into, but let me just show you. I'd be willing to bet that most of you have already seen this yourselves, but where we're going to be looking for just a second is in Matthew chapter 2, and you don't even know where I'm going yet, because there are several things in Matthew chapter 2 that we could be looking at. It's filled with these sorts of problems, but let me just take a nice one that we run into. Let's start in verse 13. Now, when they had departed, this is Joseph and Mary and the baby Jesus, behold, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream, saying, "Arise and take the child and his mother and flee to Egypt and remain there until I tell you, for Herod is going to search for the child to destroy him." And he arose and took the child and his mother by night and departed for Egypt, and was there until the death of Herod, that what was spoken by the Lord through the prophet might be fulfilled, saying, "Out of Egypt did I call my son." Now, and that's the quote from the Old Testament that we're interested in. "Out of Egypt did I call my son." Well, okay, this sounds interesting. We have, maybe it's in one of the books of the prophets, we have a prophetic statement predicting that God was going to take Jesus someday, his Messiah, and he was in Egypt, and he had to call him out of there and take him back to Jerusalem. And in fact, we might even get the idea that what this story is telling us is that the reason that God had to take Mary and Joseph and Jesus and take them to Egypt was so that he could fulfill this prophecy that he was going to take them, he was going to call his son out of Egypt. So let's go look at the prophecy that we're talking about here and see this prediction in action. It's in the book of Hosea, which is always hard to find. That's in the minor prophets. That's after Daniel. And we're in chapter 11. So in Hosea 11. Now, if we go and we do the sort of thing that I've been talking about, we think about the context here. Hosea, in his book, has this tendency to sort of go back and forth between the proclamation of the judgment that God is bringing on Israel for their apostasy and unbelief, and then reminding them of his goodness towards them and that he's going to bring them back, that he's not always going to be angry with them, but that he's going to restore them back to their land. So in chapter 11, we're in one of these restoration sections. He's just been telling them about how they're going to be getting it, but now he's talking about how he has been kind to them in the past and how he's going to be kind to them again in the future. He says, "When Israel was a youth, I loved him, and out of Egypt I called my son. The more they called them, the more they went from them. They kept sacrificing to the Baals and burning incense to idols. Yet it is I who taught Ephraim to walk. I took them in my arms, but they did not know that I healed them. I led them with cords of a man, with bonds of love, and I became to them as one who lifts the yoke from their jaws, and I bent down and fed them." Now, does it sound to you in this case like "out of Egypt I called my son" is a prediction that one day Jesus was going to go to Egypt and God was going to take him out? I see people shaking. No, that's what I would say. Out of Egypt, I mean, isn't it fairly clear, I think, that God is talking about the great redemptive act in history, in the past, to this time, when God took Israel, took his people, out of Egypt, the bondage and captivity they were in there, and led them out of there to a land that they had that he had promised them. And he uses that in this case. Later in the chapter, you see him saying, like in 9, "I will not execute my fierce anger. I will not destroy Ephraim again. For I am God and not man, the Holy One in your midst, and I will not come in wrath." In 11, "They will come trembling like birds from Egypt and like doves from the land of Assyria, and I will settle them in their houses." And here's his promise that, like what he did before, when he took them out of captivity in Egypt, that he's going to bring them out of the captivity to Assyria. And this is, Hosea is talking to Ephraim. This is the people in the northern kingdom, many of whom were taken off to Assyria. And he's saying, like what God did in the past, what he's going to do in the future. So, we have this problem. It sounds as if Matthew is saying that Jesus coming out of Egypt and coming back to Judea was a fulfillment of this prophecy in Hosea. But when we go to Hosea and look at it in terms of the context and what does it seem most likely that this passage is trying to say, it doesn't seem to be talking about that at all. So, there are two sort of adverse responses that we could have to that, both of which I would like to try to work against a little bit tonight. One is, see, your approach, my approach, to interpretation doesn't work. And so we shouldn't be looking at the Bible that way. But instead, we should see the Bible as filled with inner messages from God that have nothing to do with context and authorial intent and that sort of thing. And that's the way we ought to approach it. It's the way that, obviously, the New Testament authors approached it, where what the author meant to say is not the issue, it's that message in there from God. Another approach would be, see, your approach to interpretation doesn't work. I agree with you that language works that way, and we ought to interpret the Bible that way, but clearly that's not the way they interpreted it, and what that shows me is that this whole thing doesn't work. The Bible cannot be the authoritative book that you've said it is, thank you. Because, clearly, I mean, if that's the way the New Testament authors are going to interpret this stuff, they must really not know what they're talking about. I mean, they're just, obviously, they're trying to twist the evidence around to make it say things that it was never trying to say. There is a middle ground. Those who say, well, it was okay for the apostles to interpret that way because they were inspired, but we can't interpret that way because we're not inspired. I personally think that that is a counsel of despair. That we're basically taking inspiration and making it a magic wand to wave it over the problem and pretend like it isn't there. But I don't think we can do that. What I'd like to do tonight is just give you something of an idea of how I would answer this kind of objection, how I would approach the problem. What do I think is going on? I would like to be able to come along and say, here, let's go quickly over 10 really difficult passages in the New Testament, and I'll show you the little trick that solves them all. I would like to be able to do that, but in the first place, some of the ones that I bet you would take me to and ask me to find the trick, I'm not sure myself yet. I'm still wondering what to do with some of those passages. But my concern tonight is to not just to be able to solve a few problems with a trick or two, but I think that fundamentally there is one thing at the heart of this problem. And if we can get at that, I think we'll be well on our way to understanding how we should approach the problem. So that's what I want to get at tonight. And so I'm going to take you to a couple of passages where I think I do understand what's happening and suggest that in some of these other problem passages that it's working the same way. And that's as far as we're going to be able to get with it tonight, I think. Before we go to any particular passages, and I have a couple in mind, let me sort of set the stage for how I'd answer this question. First of all, I would like to maintain that when we look at many of these problem passages, passages like the one in Matthew that we were just looking at, that part of what is confusing to us is that I think the authors are not doing exegesis. They're not doing interpretation at that point. They're doing theology. What I mean by that is their exegesis, their interpretation of the passage is hidden from us. They're not telling us how they interpret the passage, what they think the author was saying. What they're doing is saying is they've gone through actually a very big process that we all go through as we read the Bible and try to come to understand it. I read what it says here. I understand what the author is saying. I see theological implications to what he's saying. I take that and put it together with the other things that I know from what the Bible is saying, and I come up with this picture of reality. I come up with a theology, a system of thought about how all of this works. And then what the authors are doing are going and they're pointing at a particular passage and utilizing it for a theological purpose, that this passage is getting at actually a whole area of theology that you have to be able to understand in order to understand the point that they're making. Now, it may seem as if that's quite a statement to make, and maybe it's just a way, my own magic wand, to wave over the problem and make it go away. And so part of what I want to do is try to demonstrate that I think we can make the case that that's in fact what's happening, in some areas at any rate, and then carry that over into others. Part of the reason that they can do this, part of what the solution to this problem is going to be based in the fact that God does not change and that there is a theological unity to the Bible. But more specifically and more importantly, I think, there is one unifying purpose and direction and goal to the Bible. It's not just that it all hangs together, but that right from the beginning, God has a purpose in mind. That purpose, and we could talk about as his determination from the beginning to redeem us from the problem of the fall. And the fall is introduced to us very quickly in the Bible, and really from then on, I would say, we see God beginning to interact with us and saying, look, I'm going to be doing something about this. And I would like to suggest that that theme runs all through the Old Testament and that it is tapping into that theme that is the rationale behind these quotations of the Old Testament that we see the New Testament authors doing. And if we understand something about that theme, we can understand better how they're tapping into it. So, let me give you a little bit of how I picture this working. What is this flow of thought that the New Testament authors are tapping into, and then I'll try to give you some examples of how I think they're tapping into it. God, from very close to the beginning of the Old Testament, has been telling us that he has in mind that he is going to bring redemption and salvation into the world. And one of the first places, I won't say the first place because there are other places in Genesis that have a good chance at having some hints about God's purpose in them, but one of the first clear places where this shows up is in the life of Abraham, and we talk about the Abrahamic covenant, God coming along and promising to do certain things with Abraham. And one of the most important statements that we run into in God's dealing with Abraham is in chapter 12, where we read, "Now the Lord said to Abram, go forth from your country and from your relatives and from your father's house to the land which I will show you, and I will make you a great nation, and I will bless you and make your name great. And so you shall be a blessing, and I will bless those who bless you, and the one who curses you I will curse, and in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed." Now here's this sort of overarching statement, very unspecific, but God coming to Abraham and saying, I'm going to do something very big through you. I'm going to bless you, and not only that, but you, through this blessing that I am bringing to you, you are going to bless others. And in fact, all the families of the earth are going to be blessed somehow in you. Not being very specific about how that works. Now, way at the other end, we read Paul saying in Galatians 3, we can look at 7 and 8 here, "Therefore be sure that it is those who are of faith that are sons of Abraham. And the Scripture, foreseeing that God would justify the Gentiles, or justify the nations, by faith, preached the gospel beforehand to Abraham, saying, all the nations shall be blessed in you." Here's Paul saying that that was a proclamation of the gospel. What does he mean by that? Well, I think he has two things in mind. The fact that God promised that this great blessing was going to come through Abraham, and specifically through the descendants of Abraham. That's the blessing that he's talking about, is in fact the gospel, what we come to understand later on as the gospel. And also what Paul has in mind is that God is saying here that this blessing is not just going to be to Abraham and his people, but it's going to be to all the families of the earth. So this blessing is not just to the Jewish people, those who are descendants of Abraham, but it's going to be to everyone. And that was made clear right at the very beginning, almost the first clear statement of God that he's going to do something. He says, I'm going to do this great thing, I'm going to do it through you, and it's not just going to be for you and your people, but it's going to be for everyone. So, yes, okay. And one other place I think is interesting to note where that same passage gets referred to is in the book of Acts, chapter 3. At the end, Peter is giving a sermon, and in verse 25, let's start with 24, "And likewise, all the prophets who have spoken, from Samuel and his successors onward, also announced these days." Peter's trying to make the connection between what I'm proclaiming now is something that goes back. It's been talked about all along the way. "It is you who are the sons of the prophets, and you are the sons of the covenant which God made with your fathers, saying to Abraham, and in your seed all the families of the earth shall be blessed. For you first, you Jews, God raised up his servant and sent him to bless you by turning every one of you from your wicked ways." And here is Peter saying that this promise of blessing that was given to Abraham, he's getting specific here and saying that the coming of Jesus, the death of Jesus, the resurrection of Jesus that I'm proclaiming to you, that is the fulfillment of the promise that was made to Abraham. And the blessing that's coming to you specifically is turning every one of you from your wicked ways. So he's seeing that what he's asserting is that the general promise that God made there, what he had in mind, what he had been shooting for all along, was that he was going to send Jesus and that Jesus was going to solve the problem of sin, that we would be turned from our wicked ways. So back here, we have this very general statement that in Abraham and in his descendants, these things are going to be happening. And my assertion would be that all along, God is pointing ahead to what he was going to do in Jesus. That we're not reading anything into what God said back there. That is what he had been pointing at all along in a very general way. Okay, so we move along now. God comes along and Israel, the descendants of Abraham are in captivity in Egypt, and God takes them out of there to a land that he had promised them. In fact, the land that he had promised to Abraham back when the whole thing had started. This is God being kind to his people in a specific way, it's true, But it's also one of the steps in the process of him fulfilling the promises that he had made back in the beginning. We move along then to Israel living in the land that God had promised, and they come to have a king. His name was David. And God comes to David and tells him that the throne that he has, the throne that he is sitting on, is never going to be replaced with a different dynasty. You know, Saul got the throne and then he lost it, and his family was never in power again. David, however, his throne is going to be an eternal throne. It's going to last forever. God isn't real specific there about how that's going to happen, but these promises are given to David, and along with that, promises that his throne is going to be instrumental in bringing about some of the other promises that God has been making that he's going to do for Israel. When Israel goes into captivity in Assyria and Babylon, things look grim. What happened to God's promise? Where is God's throne? And here the prophets come along with all the more clarity and insistence, saying, God's promise has not been thrown down. He did this to you here to teach you something, but the fact is that his throne remains, and there is coming one who is going to be a son of David, a descendant of David, who is going to sit on this throne, and he is going to bring about all of the promises that God has been making. You know how God promised that you would dwell in peace and safety? He's going to bring that about. You know how God has promised that he's going to give you a new heart and make new people of you so that you no longer break his law? This is the one that's going to bring that about. And so it's becoming clearer and clearer that these blessings that were promised to Abraham back here and come to center in David's throne somehow, as we come closer and closer to the time of the New Testament, it's narrowing down to there is this one guy, there is this figure that we're waiting for, who is going to be the fulfillment of everything that God has been saying he was going to do right from the beginning. Now, that, I think, is the theological stream, the theological arrow in the Old Testament that the New Testament authors are tapping into at various points along the way and saying, this stuff points to Jesus, the one that we're talking about now. But they do it in various ways. Let me take you to...
Yes. Before you go on to the next section, I understand the major point about looking forward to Christ to turn you from your wicked ways, but I have to raise a concern about the interpretation that you just did. And Acts 3:26.
Yes.
Because I'm following the process okay, and I still like what you're teaching me, but I'm fearful that God didn't send Jesus to turn us from our wicked ways, but God sent his servant, John the Baptist, to bless you and turn you from your wicked ways. I'm not so sure that that's a reference to Christ, but rather to the one who came before Christ. And I hope this is not inappropriate to point that out now.
No, not at all.
And ask you if that fits the way you're thinking.
Right. Well, that is an option. I mean, he's in the earlier section before it, he talks about a prophet, going back to what Moses had said in his dealings with Israel, and talking about a prophet that God was going to raise up.
Mm-hmm.
And there is debate around as to whether that is a reference to the Messiah,
yes,
or a precursor to the Messiah. And it's a good question. It's entirely possible that, I mean, it's certainly a good option to consider at that spot that he's thinking about John the Baptist. I think he's talking about Jesus. But if he was talking about John the Baptist, I don't think it would substantially change the point I'm trying to make. Because
that's what I was trying to say too. Yes, I agree. It wouldn't change the point that you're making, but I needed to ask you about this more specific.
Right. Well, maybe we could talk about it afterwards.
Absolutely.
Or something. It's certainly a legitimate option.
Mm-hmm.
I've gone the other way, but I could be convinced back the other way too.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, The passage I want to start with is the in one of the most problematic books that deals with the Old Testament, so we might as well jump into something thorny right away, although not too thorny to start out with, and that's the book of Hebrews. Hebrews is often getting a bad rap for playing fast and loose with the Old Testament, and clearly there are some of the uses of the Old Testament in Hebrews that are difficult to understand. But I have been gaining in confidence that the author of Hebrews knows what he's doing, because the more of his uses of the Old Testament that I've had an opportunity to look at, the more I think makes sense. I cannot make sense out of all of them yet, but since a lot of them are making sense, it gives me hope that maybe actually all of them make sense. And that's the best I can do at this point. But and that's basically what I want to do with the rest of the evening, is suggest that to you where my hopes are headed and what I think is the most profitable way to approach this problem. We'll read in the beginning. God, after he spoke long ago to the fathers in the prophets in many portions and in many ways. I'm sorry, we're right at the chapter 1 of Hebrews. In these last days has spoken to us in his Son, whom he appointed heir of all things, through whom also he made the world. And he is the radiance of his glory and the exact representation of his nature, and upholds all things by the word of his power. When he had made purification of sins, he sat down at the right hand of the Majesty on high, having become as much better than the angels as he has inherited a more excellent name than they. For to which of the angels did he ever say, "You are my son, today I have begotten you"? And again, "I will be a father to him, and he shall be a son to me." It's those two verses that I want to start with. The author of Hebrews is saying that Jesus has a more excellent name than the angels. And one way that we could interpret the two passages that he's quoting from here is to think, well, he's going back and he's looking at specific prophecies in the Old Testament that relate to Jesus, where Jesus is referred to in a father and son relationship with God. We're already prepared with our theology that Jesus is the Son of God, which means he's the second person of the Trinity, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. And these passages back there are suggesting that that's the very sort of relationship that this coming Jesus would have with God. So let's go and look at the two passages that the author of Hebrews is quoting here. The first one is in Psalm 2. Psalm 2. Why are the nations in an uproar, and the peoples devising a vain thing? The kings of the earth take their stand, and the rulers take counsel together against the Lord and against his anointed. Now, a little reminder there. Against the Lord and against his anointed. That's the word there, Messiah. Against his Messiah, or Mashiach. That Messiah means anointed one. So, that Hebrew word there is the word from which we get the title Messiah that we apply to Jesus. Let us tear their fetters apart and cast away their cords from us. He who sits in the heavens laughs. The Lord scoffs at them. Then he will speak to them in his anger and terrify them in his fury. But as for me, I have installed my king upon Zion, my holy mountain. I will surely tell of the decree of the Lord. He said to me, "You are my son. Today I have begotten you. Ask of me, and I will surely give the nations as your inheritance, and the very ends of the earth as your possession. You shall break them with a rod of iron. You shall shatter them like earthenware. Now therefore, O kings, show discernment. Take warning, O judges of the earth. Worship the Lord with reverence and rejoice with trembling. Do homage to the Son, lest he become angry and you perish in the way, for his wrath may soon be kindled. How blessed are all who take refuge in him." All right. Well, it's sure possible to take that as a prediction of Jesus, if we want to. The word Messiah is used. He's, "You are my son, today I've begotten you," and shatter them like earthenware, break them with a rod of iron. That sounds like language that we're familiar with being used concerning Jesus, and his wrath may soon be kindled and all of that. Sure. Now, I'm saying that's a possible way of taking the psalm. Let's look at the other passage that the author of Hebrews is referring to, which is in 2 Samuel chapter 7. Chapter 7, at verse 8, my Bible has a little label that says, God's covenant with David. Real significant. This is, we talked about the Abrahamic covenant a few minutes ago. Well, when I said earlier that God came to David and promised him that he was going to have this great throne, this is it. This is the place where that happens. And it's referred to as the Davidic covenant sometimes, the covenant that God made with David. In verse 12, it says, when your days are complete and you lie down with your fathers, I will raise up your descendant after you, who will come forth from you, and I will establish his kingdom. He shall build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. I will be a father to him, and he will be a son to me. When he commits iniquity, I will correct him with the rod of men and the strokes of the sons of men. But my loving kindness shall not depart from him, as I took it away from Saul, whom I removed from before you. And your house and your kingdom shall endure before me forever. Your throne shall be established forever. Now, very, very important passage in the Old Testament. But we have to notice something. It was chapter 7,
yeah,
verse 12. This guy, I will raise up your descendant after you, and I will establish his kingdom. Who is this? Let me tell you who I think it is. I think it's Solomon. He shall build a house for my name. This is, David had been thinking that he was going to build a temple for God, build the temple. God says, no, you're not going to build a temple. You're not going to make a house for me. I'm going to make a house for you. That is, a house as in a dynasty I'm going to make for you. But in terms of making a house for me, you're not going to do it. But you're going to have a descendant, and he's going to make a house for me. And the fact is, that's what happened. That's why we call it Solomon's Temple, is because Solomon is the one who built it. And then, I will be a father to him, and he will be a son to me. When he commits iniquity, I will correct him with the rod of men and the strokes of the sons of men. That's a little bit unfortunate if we're talking about Jesus, because Jesus certainly didn't need it. But what we do have in this statement, along with this, that Solomon is going to come and his throne is going to be established and he's going to build this house, is this promise to David that this throne of his son, his next in line, is going to last forever. So this is a promise that extends beyond Solomon. And I think we are right and can legitimately say that this relationship that God is saying that he is going to enter into with Solomon is the same relationship that he's going to enter into with Solomon's son, and then the next king after that, and the next king after that. That the statement, I will be a father to him and he will be a son to me, is a general statement about this unique relationship that God is entering into with the king of Israel. Now we have to remember, in Psalm 2, I was pointing out the word Messiah is used there. The word Messiah, I would maintain, we can find it a number of places in the Old Testament. In almost every one of those places, it is used to refer to the king of Israel. It's used to refer to Saul, it's used to refer to David, to Solomon, etc. The anointed one is that one whom God has picked out and put on the throne. My argument at this point would be that what God is doing, just like God made this general promise that back at Abraham, that through Abraham and his descendants, this blessing was going to be coming. That he's telling David that, yes, you're going to have a son who is going to sit on your throne, but that throne is going to be eternal. There are promises connected with this throne. There's going to be a certain nature to this rule, we find out as we read in other places. And it's not any one particular king. Solomon doesn't fulfill all of the promises that God makes to David. The next king along doesn't fulfill all of those promises, but that throne is intimately connected with those promises. So at one and the same time, God is talking about, yes, there is Solomon, And then, by implication, the others who are going to come and sit on that throne, since it's an eternal throne. But he is also pointing to the purpose of that throne and where it's headed. Just like the blessings that Abraham are going to be bringing, that's head pointed in a certain direction. That the Davidic covenant is pointed in a certain direction. And the prophets come along and make that more explicit to us. It's pointed in the direction of this one guy who's going to come and sit on that throne forever. It's not this promise here is not going to be fulfilled by an unbroken succession of different kings forever, but it's going to come the day when this one king is going to come. He's going to sit on that throne forever. So it gets more explicit as we go along, but that's the sort of thing that God is talking about here. This eternal throne finds its eternal nature in Jesus. So Jesus really is, in a sense, the fulfillment, ultimately, of what God is telling David here. And Jesus is, just like Solomon was, and the other kings of Israel, he is in a unique relationship with God, this father-son relationship between the king of Israel and God. Now, obviously, there is something very unique about the relationship that Jesus had with God, and I don't want to belittle that. But the fact is that there is also something about the relationship that Jesus had with God that is like the relationship that all of the kings of Israel had. All of them were sitting on a throne that had these promises. All of them were a unique individual in that they were given authority to rule over God's people. It's just that there was one coming who was going to rule in a final and unique way. Now, when we look even at Psalm 2 that we just looked at a minute ago, many have argued, and I think at this point that I agree with them, that Psalm 2 was written originally to be a coronation psalm. That it was written, that this language, "You are my son, today I have begotten you," was the language that was addressed to the king on the day he was crowned king. That is, today you have entered into that father-son relationship with me that I was talking about in my covenant that I made with David. So that each one of the kings along the line would have heard these words, "You are my son, today I have begotten you." But Jesus comes along and again enters into that relationship uniquely because he is the one who is always intended from the beginning to come along and fulfill all of the promises inherent in that throne. Now, if we go back to Hebrews, notice what is the argument that the author of Hebrews is making. I pointed it out in verse 4. Jesus, he sat down at the right hand of the Majesty on high, having become as much better than the angels, as he has inherited a more excellent name than they. He has inherited a more excellent name. This is something that was passed down to him, this name. What's the name? Well, the author of Hebrews started out saying, in the last days he has spoken to us in his Son. And what's the first passages that he quotes here? "You are my son, today I have begotten you. And again, I will be a father to him, and he shall be a son to me." The argument that the author of Hebrews is making is, look, you guys are all upset and all hot and bothered because you think that angels are really hot stuff. Angels are these supernatural beings. They're way above men in the hierarchy of beings in the world because they fly around and they do all kinds of great stuff. Now, you're bothered by the fact that Jesus is a man. And I would say that if we go through the first part of Hebrews, I think it's fairly evident that the problem that they're wrestling with is Jesus' humanity. To their way of thinking, that visions from angels and stuff like that would be a flashier way of for God to do stuff, and they're more inclined to pay attention to that sort of thing than they are to this man who came along, who after all was a man. And so the argument that the author of Hebrews is making in here is that, look, Jesus, when he sat down at the right hand of the Majesty on high, that is, when he was crowned, when he attained to his throne, he became as much better than the angels by virtue of the title that he had. you know what the word angel means. It's messenger. The word angel is just the Greek word for messenger. And it's a translation of Hebrew word for messenger. I mean, messenger, that's what the angels were. So what the author of Hebrews is doing here is saying, let's compare how we talk about these. Jesus has inherited this name, which is the Son of God. He is in a father-son relationship with God. Angels are messengers. They're flunkies. They're just sent to do stuff that God tells them to do. And that's why he goes along to say, of the angels, he says, and here the New American Standard, I think, has the wrong word order. It should be, who makes the winds his messengers and a flame of fire his ministers. That is, he's going to a thing in the Old Testament to say, look, God can take any old thing and turn it into a messenger. Being a messenger is no big deal. But of the Son, he says, your throne, O God, is forever and ever, and the righteous scepter is the scepter of his kingdom. You have loved righteousness and hated lawlessness. Therefore, God, your God, has anointed you with the oil of gladness above your companions. There's another passage that we could go and look at and raise some questions over. I would just argue here that when it says your throne, O God, contrary to what many people say at this point, this is not the author of Hebrews saying, see, it says that Jesus is God. I don't think that O God was addressed to the Messiah. That when it says your throne is forever and ever, and you have been anointed above your companions with the oil of gladness, that this is talking about the throne that God promised to David that was going to last forever. Your throne is forever and ever. But it is a throne that is a throne that God put there. Okay, now we could go into that. I don't want to do any more of that right now.
In Psalm 2 then, when he says, he said to me, thou art my son, is that where he's quoting 2 Samuel? And then, and when he says, today I have begotten thee, that's back to David speaking. I mean, this is really David talking about what God said to him, and he's talking about coronating Solomon. Is that the...
Well, it doesn't say what the situation is, but if it is a coronation psalm, then the best bet is that, I think, that David wrote it for as a coronation psalm for Solomon, and that it was in fact used then afterward for each king after that. No, I think that's the king himself speaking at that spot, saying, you have said to me, you are my son, today I have begotten you. That is, the day of the beginning is this day when he is crowned. That is, it's this irony that here's this grown man saying, I have been born today, in the sense that I have just become the son of someone that I was not the son of before. Unfortunately, this passage and the things involved with it are more complicated than I can go into all it now. If I were better at this, maybe I could, but I can't at this point. But what I'd like to suggest is that the author of Hebrews is seeing the theology behind those statements, that there was this unique eternal throne that God had set up, and that he had set aside some men, and yet always in the background, preeminently, one man that was going to sit on that throne and fulfill the promises that God had made. And he entered into this father-son relationship with God, this unique, intimate relationship with God, where he was ruling with the authority of God and all of the things that went along with that. Yes?
Is that what the New Testament writers mean when they said that Jesus saw the glory that was to be given him?
It may be. I hadn't thought about that. There's certainly a lot of glory in that sense associated with the promises that had been made to Jesus. I mean, the throne that was ahead of him was tremendous. I can't remember specifically the context that you're talking about, so I'm not sure. I'd point out one other. At the end of this chapter, he says, to which of the angels has he ever said, sit at my right hand until I make your enemies a footstool for your feet? That is a quote from Psalm 110, which Jesus quotes and interprets for us, I think, in a way that I think is pretty straightforward. In Psalm 110, we have David saying, Yahweh, in Psalm 110 it says, the Lord says to my Lord, but don't be confused by that. It's Yahweh says to my Lord. So God says to my Lord, sit at my right hand until I make your enemies a footstool for your feet. And then down in 4, the Lord has sworn and will not change his mind, you are a priest forever according to the order of Melchizedek. Jesus points at this passage and says, who wrote this? And I said, David. He says, okay, well, and who's he talking about here? The Messiah, right? So why does David, who the Messiah is the son of David, and we talk about the Messiah being the son of David, why is David talking to his son and calling him Lord? Because we have David writing this saying, God says to my Lord. Well, who is David's Lord? And I think the point that Jesus is making is that this is David understanding that although he is the first in line for this throne, he is not the last in line. And in fact, there is someone coming who is going to sit on that throne that in relationship to him, he will be his Lord.
And so the point is when Jesus says, before David I was, wasn't that he was a pre-existent Christ, but that the fact...
It was before Abraham.
Oh, before... Okay. What does Jesus... Doesn't he go on to say something about when he does that? Why did the Lord's... You know, why did David say to my Lord? Doesn't he make another point after that about...
Well, not right there. I mean, the part you're talking about, it is in one of those dialogues in John with the folks, but I'm not sure they're...
Well, I guess what I'm saying is, was Jesus saying then that this had been that he's fulfilling this promise, not that he had existed?
Well, I had always taken it that he was saying that he had existed before, but that's a good question. That would be worth considering. I hadn't connected those in my mind before. All right, now, why am I saying all of this stuff? What I'm trying to say is that there is throughout the whole Testament a whole series of these arrows that at one and the same time they're talking about something that's going on now, but they also have implications for these promises that God is making for the future. So I would like to contend that many of these passages that end up being problems where we think, gee, it doesn't seem as if... Is that passage really talking about Jesus? I would say, no, that passage isn't talking about Jesus specifically, but it's talking about something that is related to the promises that God has made that find their fulfillment in Jesus. And that's what the New Testament authors are doing. They're pointing to a theology. They're saying, look, you see this here? This here has theological implications for what we're doing here. Now, can I make that stick in all of the problem passages? Whoa. There are a lot of problem passages, and some of them I'm not sure what I would say. Let me just take a shot at the out of Egypt I called my son passage. I am not confident at this point that this is the way to explain this. This seems to me a good way to explain it. I wanted to take you to this passage because this is definitely one of the hardest ones, and I want to show you, and I want to be honest with you, how sometimes we seem like, we're right out there on the edge of, is that going to work? But I think that we could make a case for something like this. So let me take you there and show you what I think might be going on. In Hosea, the passage, out of Egypt I called my son, if we think about that passage, what's the significance of that passage? What did God say that for? What was it pointing to? Here is a time when God's people are suffering. They're off in captivity. It sure looks as if things don't go their way, that they could get snuffed out altogether. We've already seen an example of this where here's Israel in captivity in Egypt and things are not looking good for them, and yet God comes along being faithful to his promise and brings them out. Okay, Hosea is pointing at what God did in Egypt and saying, look, God is still committed to you and still committed to his promises in the same way that he was then. And so, you're not going to be left in Egypt again. Yes, you're out there in Assyria, and some of you are in Egypt right now. I think I would, the way I understand what he's saying, because I think some of the Jews were taken to Egypt, and some of them were taken to Assyria. And so he says, some of you are back in Egypt, and some of you are in Assyria, but the fact is that I'm going to call you out of there again. The fact is that I'm still committed to what I said I was going to do. I'm not going to let this wipe you out. I am going to restore you to the land and do the things that I said I was going to do. That's what Hosea is saying by referring to that passage. Egypt is the place of danger, the place where God's people, who are not just, see, what I want to, the point I want to make is, they're not just people that God has said, I'm going to do nice things for, but they are also the people on whom God's promises are riding. That is, the blessing that God promised to bring to the world is through Abraham, and it's specifically through Abraham's people. If God lets the Israel be wiped out, then there goes the promise, not just to be nice to them, but that through them the whole world was going to be blessed. There goes the whole shooting match. So the significance in Hosea of saying, out of Egypt I called my son, is it saying, look, I have this intimate relationship with Israel. They are my children. Israel is my son. And I've been taking care of him all along. I promised that I was going to do all of these things with him, and by gum, I've been doing it. I did it before, and I'm going to do it again. That's what Hosea is saying, what God is saying to Hosea in that. Now, if we look at that as a prediction that Jesus is going to come out of Egypt someday, all of the significance of that is gone. There's no problem in Egypt. Egypt's a fine place for, I mean, that's why they went there, is because it's a fine place to be in Matthew. All of that stuff is gone. But look at where he quotes it. In Matthew 2, he says, he arose and took the child and his mother by night and departed for Egypt and was there until the death of Herod. That what was spoken by the Lord through the prophet might be fulfilled, saying, out of Egypt did I call my son. Well, if we were to think about where is the promise through Abraham in danger in this situation, it wasn't in Egypt, it was Herod going to wipe out all of the kids. Why did God send them to Egypt in the first place? So I think that one could make a good case. Although it is, I sense there is a part of you that I don't mean you, I mean a part of all of us that feels like, well, there's a kind of a stretch happening here. This is not the first thing you think of when you read this passage. But if we're to grant that Matthew knows perfectly well what Hosea was doing when he said this stuff, then what Matthew is referring to, what's being fulfilled here, is God's commitment to his saving purpose, that he's always going to intervene on the behalf of Israel, his son, to fulfill his purposes. And now we have gotten to that place where the promises that God has made to Israel have come to focus in one person. It's this one Messiah that we've been waiting for all this time who is going to fulfill all these promises. And so what Matthew may be saying is that it is God coming, bringing Jesus out of Israel into Egypt. I mean, I think in a way he's aware of the irony in what he's saying, that here God is fulfilling his purpose to Israel by taking Israel and taking him out of Judea into Egypt to save him from the threat. Before, we always had the threat being in Egypt, and we're taking you to Jerusalem, to Judea, to get you out of it. But now I'm taking you out of Judea to Egypt in order that I might fulfill my promise to preserve you, in order that all the purposes I have for you might be fulfilled. So, now, I admittedly, that's a stretch. It doesn't read that way the first time you come across it. I guess what I'd like to say, though, is that I think that all of these problem passages, especially at the beginning of Matthew, are of that same nature. When he says it fulfilled what it said through the prophet, that part of our problem is that we have misunderstood what it means for it to be fulfilled. We think that what he means is it was a prediction and now it happened. But if we had a chance to explore this word fulfilled, I would argue that instead, that what we see is that the idea is that what was implicit back here has come to pass here. That we've moved from something shadowy and vague, and now we're coming to where it's really coming into its own. It has fully come to pass, and it's really coming around in a big way now. That's not a very good way to say it. And we're running out of time, so I don't have a lot more description to make about that at this point. But I would recommend that you look, for instance, at James 2, the faith and works section, and we'll be looking at that in the James part in the spring, but where James says that when Abraham offered Isaac, it fulfilled what was said in the scriptures, and Abraham believed God and it was reckoned to him as righteousness. That's not a prediction that Abraham was going to sacrifice Isaac, but instead it takes what was implicit in the statement of faith that Abraham made back here and fulfills it. It fills it up. It completes it and actualizes it and that sort of thing. And that's what we're saying here, is that what God had been doing in general and shadowy ways for Israel back here, he is fulfilling now in the person of Jesus. This is where it's really happening, where it's really being filled up. It's coming into its fullness, because Jesus is the one who is coming to bring about these things that God had promised. There is a word that sometimes gets associated with this stuff. It's the word typology. And you may have heard people refer to typology in the Old Testament as if it was something like this, that a type in the Old Testament is like a sort of a historical allegory. You know, I read about Israel going into the Promised Land, but really it's a code for my facing battles in my walk of faith or something like that. What I would like to suggest is that, no, typology isn't that sort of thing. It's not a code that we're reading back out of the Old Testament, but it's rather seeing, the word type is talking about, well, I won't go into all the ins and outs of it. Let's just say that I think it points to this relationship between the shadow and the substance. Here we have the foreshadowing of it. It's coming along. We see it dimly. It's implying certain things, and here we have bonk. It comes. It's there. It has arrived. The bonk, yes. That's what the New Testament authors are seeing in Jesus, and that's what they're doing as they point to the Old Testament. They're saying, in one way or another, God's purposes that we saw dimly back here in the Old Testament now have become clear and focused in Jesus. That's what the author of Hebrews says at the very beginning when we talked there, how God spoke in various ways through the prophets and stuff, but now, today, he has spoken through his Son. And the implication being that that's the best way. That is, this is the clearest statement that God has made. Jesus is the clearest statement of God's purposes that God has ever made. And that's why, in one way, we can look at any number of things in the Old Testament and say, yeah, see, that's what God has been getting at all along. Jesus now is the fulfillment of that and the clearest expression of that. There are many problem passages that we could look at. The Isaiah passage about the virgin shall be with child, and the one here about Rachel weeping and all of that stuff. I mean, those are equally problematic, but I think that the solution to them is along the same lines. Okay, well, this ran us right to the end here. Maybe one question I could take if you've got
it. As much a question as just an observation, it seems like it kind of blows away the argument of having details fulfilled and needing all those details to be fulfilled in order to believe everything. I mean, if you look at that stuff and find the tiniest discrepancy, it's really hard to make it fit into that if that's what you're looking for. And it seems like this makes so much more sense to look at it from a theological perspective of the essence of what they were getting at, and that the New Testament writers understood that and could interpret it that way.
Right. I think so too. Let me just make one statement to that. I'm not suggesting that there is no predictive prophecy in the Old Testament. There is predictive prophecy in the Old Testament. But notice the difference. We can see it in Matthew, I think, that there is one clearly predictive prophecy given, but it's in that situation where Herod calls together the scribes and he says, basically, tell me what the predictions are concerning the Messiah. Where is he going to be? And they say, okay, well, in Bethlehem of Judea, for so it has been written by the prophet. And you, Bethlehem, land of Judah, are by no means least among the leaders of Judah, for out of you shall come forth a ruler who will shepherd my people Israel. That's a prophecy. That's talking about the Messiah. I think if you go back and look at it in context, that's clear. That's what it's talking about. But that's the question they were being asked. Give me a prophecy. Are there any predictions that tell me about where this is going to happen? And then that's the kind of answer they give it. But Matthew is not answering the question, what predictions do I have about specific things he's going to do? What he's saying is, what he wants to demonstrate is that Jesus is in line with what we would have been expecting God to do all along. And that's a bigger point. It's, in a sense, I think it's a better apologetic point than being able to demonstrate, oh, see, he said he was going to be born in, it said he was going to be born in Judah, and he was. Because one of the big questions that people face, and the challenge that we face as believers, is whether there is a unity to the revelation of Scripture, or if it isn't, in fact, just two separate, that we've got this Jewish stuff and this Christian stuff, and they're kind of like oil and water. But what the New Testament authors are doing in the way that they're quoting the Old Testament is they're saying, no, there is a great unity that binds these two things together. And the unity is God's purpose that he said right from the very beginning that he has been fulfilling all through and finalized, in one sense, in what Jesus said.
Yeah.